Jonathan Jarvis has a lot for which he's responsible. More than 400 National Park Service locations covering more than 80 million acres. As Park Service Director, Jarvis is using this year's 100th anniversary to not only promote the national parks, but also to raise funds to keep them spiffy. In part one of my interview, Jarvis describes that and what he means by the term next generation connectivity.
Well, we started into planning for this year, our 100th anniversary, 3 or 4 years ago, in partnership with the National Park Foundation and many of our other partner organizations, to really make this more than just a celebration, more than just, you know, having a big birthday cake, but really with the goal of connecting with and creating the next generation of park visitors, supporters, and advocates, and very targeted towards the millennial generation at sort of 18 to 35. And I think we've had pretty extraordinary success thus far.
And there's a big or much larger international contingent.
There is. So we've been working with Brand USA, which is sort of the overseas marketing aspect of the Department of Commerce, and promoting the national parks as a destination internationally has all kinds of positive economic benefits for the nation and sort of shows off who we are as American citizens.
And as people come to the parks, a lot of people cluster around the openings and the places easy to get to. And the real park goers, if I can use that word, know that if you can march off a couple of hundred feet or a couple of hundred yards or maybe even a couple of hundred miles, you can really get into deep wilderness and experience them in a different way. And we've got a generation of people that some of them can't walk 50 yards.
Well, I think your first comment is exactly true that, you know, even you can go to Yosemite Valley in the middle of the summer and it'll feel packed. But I guarantee you that I could take you in 5 minutes and have you, you know, almost a solitary experience and still be in the valley. And for those that want to really experience a little more of the backcountry with a little bit of effort, they can really get away from the crowds. Still lots of space out there.
And in many ways, you might suffer from the overpopularity of a few of the three or four, you know, biggest parks, and yet some of them are large and beautiful and but not so well known.
Well, that was also one of our goals, is to broaden and sort of deepen the American public's understanding of the depth and breadth of the National Park Service. That we're 412 units of the system. We're in every state and the territories from American Samoa to the Virgin Islands. And, you know, it's not all just big, you know, Western parks. There are places on the East Coast, there are places on the West Coast and in the middle of America as well.
Now, we know there's about 400 plus or minus facilities in the Park Service. Does anyone know the total acreage of all of these?
Oh, yeah, we've got it down to the decimal point, if you really want to know, in terms of the total acreage, roughly 80 million acres or so. I don't know off the top of my head what the actual number is, but there's a lot of acres.
But if you added it all up, it would be a couple of states.
Oh, yeah. Well, we have glaciers the size of states.
Right. To get back to the crowding issue, presumably the glaciers aren't crowded or probably they'd melt. Have you thought of perhaps the idea of a demand pricing system, or a way of, it might seem like you don't want it to turn into a Yogi Berra situation where they're so crowded nobody goes there anymore, but is there a way to even out the demand throughout the year, possibly?
Well, we really haven't thought about a demand pricing, because I think that we want to make sure that the parks are affordable, accessible for everyone. These places belong to all Americans, and we never want to price them out of any component of our society. So we artificially suppress the prices in order to make sure that they're available. And it's a pretty good deal. I mean, you can, for $80, you can get a pass that will be for you and your carload for an entire year to the entire national park system. That's a pretty good deal.
And that gets us to the idea of the private public partnerships and some of the revenue areas that you're exploring that are somewhat controversial. What is the plan here? What's the architecture?
So I think one misunderstanding is that the National Park Service has been working with corporate America since 1916. The railroad industry built many of the major lodges today that we, you know, hold in such high esteem, like the El Tovar and Old Faithful Inn and others, that was a partnership of the Park Service. In our 50th anniversary, you'll probably know this line, see the USA in your Chevrolet.
That
was a partnership with the automobile industry and AAA to promote the national parks. So corporate involvement, corporate sponsorship is nothing new to the Park Service. What we're trying to do is to write policies that sort of modernize our whole relationship and ensure that we're not renaming a park, or we're not saying, you know, Yosemite brought to you by, or anything like that. That we're not crossing that line. What we are saying is that we're willing to work with some of these new corporations, particularly the digital space, that how can we provide a quality experience and maybe an enhanced experience through a digital strategy, through philanthropy to support individual programs like Outreach for Kids, sponsoring school trips to parks, all those kinds of things are where we're focused our philanthropic efforts right now.
We're speaking with Jonathan Jarvis, director of the National Park Service. Now, clearly, you're not going to, you know, paint the Boeing logo on the side of the Half Dome. But if you look at, say, the Olympics and this corporate sponsorship they get, why couldn't the Park Service explore, say, a parking structure that is built and labeled by a company, or naming a road that they spend, you know, $500 million to rebuild for you, that kind of thing?
Well, I think naming things that are sort of in the face of the American people in a national park is a little bit offensive. I mean, it's sort of claiming ownership on something that belongs to everyone. So the physical assets within our national parks, it would be inappropriate, in my view, in spite of the fact that I'm sure there are people out there would give us money to do that. And I think the public would object to that. So I think that there is a place for philanthropy and corporate support, but we have to be very careful about how we apply it. And that's kind of what our new policies are driving.
Because you have mentioned David Rubenstein, who has done a lot for the city of Washington in many ways. He fixed the Washington Monument and so forth, and it's not called the Rubenstein Monument. It's still called the Washington Monument. Is there a model in that in some way that they could get some recognition, as you say, but not necessarily name things after these corporate sponsors?
Absolutely, and I think our experience with David is a good example. So David has given us money to fix the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, the Robert E. Lee Memorial, the Arlington House, the newly minted Belmont Paul Women's Equality National Monument, the Iwo Jima Memorial. And in each case, we've done a public event. We've posted on the web David's very generous contributions. And during the construction, he gets some temporal recognition through wayside exhibits and others, but it's not a permanent renaming. And David has been very, very satisfied with that kind of recognition. So that is a good example of how we can recognize the contributions of both individuals as well as the private sector.
And do you think, or do you sense that there's demand from other people like him for this sort of thing?
I think there is. You know, we launched a fundraising campaign as a part of our centennial in partnership with the National Park Foundation, and that is well on its way to raising $350 million for the national parks, and that is both individual foundation and corporate sponsorships. So it's while David is certainly at the top of the heap, there are others that are stepping up.
Safe to say that the centennial celebration has brought a bounce to the interest in the Park Service from both visitors and philanthropists?
Absolutely. We've seen a significant bounce, an increase in visitation, a broader representation of the American public within that visitation, and certainly a higher interest in volunteerism. So before we launched the centennial campaign, we were at about 250,000 volunteers, and we're now over 400,000 volunteers that have stepped up.
And do you think people might be more inclined to come to the United States, given the state of turmoil elsewhere in the world and maybe people's sense of danger? U.S. national parks are safe also.
They're very safe, and they're very attractive, and they're, you know, well recognized for the quality of public service that we provide. So we have been promoting them as a part of international tourism, and particularly kind of focused on Asia now as the economy grows in China and other parts, India, that they come to the United States and see these great national parks, and it brings it back to their own countries to help them establish or maintain or enhance their own national park system as well.
And about those 400,000 volunteers, what types of things can they do, and how do you characterize them? Are they mostly young, mostly old, retirees, or just all of the above?
It's all of the above, and they do just about all of the above work. Everything from doing backcountry patrol in the Rocky Mountain National Park to helping us with kids programs, to doing natural resources monitoring, to just picking up trash. I mean, they do it all. We love our volunteers.
Now, that gets to the issue of personnel in the National Park Service, and you've got a widely flung set of personnel. They're all over the country, really. And there have been some issues, frankly, and they've been in congressional hearings and so forth about locuses of sexual harassment and this kind of thing. What are you doing long-term as you look at the workforce and the quality and quantity that you require?
Well, the Park Service is a big organization. Like I said, we have about 22,000 permanent employees, and we bring in about 7,000 to 8,000 seasonal. So that's a 30,000 personnel organization. And as you said, we're spread across the country in remote locations in the national parks. These recent revelations coming from investigations by the IG around sexual harassment at the Grand Canyon and some other parks are incredibly disturbing to me and to the senior leadership of the Park Service. So a couple things that we've jumped on right away. One is we've changed some leadership at the Canyon, and we've got a brand new superintendent going in there, Chris Lennertz, first female superintendent in the history of Grand Canyon, and she's addressing it, you know, very, very specifically at that park. And then nationwide, we've engaged some other in the federal family, like the Department of Defense, to learn from their experiences, how they address harassment within the various branches of the military. We've talked to some of the other agencies, how they've addressed it, and we've learn from that. And so one is we are planning a survey of all of our employees this fall to determine the prevalence of and their own experience collected in an anonymous way. That gives us sort of a baseline. We're looking at all of our reporting capabilities and the opportunity for a hotline for individuals to be able to report. And then really enhancing our response side of this to ensure that actions are moved quickly, disciplinary action is taken, victims are supported, and we root this out of the system.
In some ways, you've got in a unique situation in that for, I think, a lot of people that go into this as a career, it's something of a calling. It's not just any old federal career. It might be a love of the outdoors. Plus, you've got isolated, distant locations where people are hard to supervise and hard to see at times.
All of that is true. It's a very much of a mission-driven workforce. People come to work for the Park Service because they love the mission, and the mission being that on one hand, we are to preserve these extraordinary places. We have a responsibility to tell America's story through place. So a Gettysburg or a battlefield or an Ebenezer Baptist Church, Dr. King's church, or the Selma to Montgomery Trail, or Manzanar, where Japanese Americans were confined during World War II, or, you know, the history of a bison in America, as told in Yellowstone, or complex issues like climate change. A lot of people are really attracted to that mission, and that we're to help the public have a great experience, have fun, learn something, and have that park experience safely at the same time. And people love that aspect of the National Park Service, and it keeps them in a long time, like me. This is my 40th year. So,
and with respect to that storytelling mission that you mentioned, you also said earlier that there is you're looking at ways to use technology and multimedia to have a greater role in all of that. What are some of the things you're exploring there?
Well, one is engaging young people and helping us understand how they use technology within the social media, within their peer networks, and how they want to use that to tell the stories. You know, I'm kind of an old Luddite, but this next generation is really into the use of technology. So in part, we've got to have connectivity, at least in some parts of our national parks. So bringing in that connectivity, working with these technology companies to ensure that if you're on the south rim of the Grand Canyon, you can hook to wireless. Now, if you're at the bottom of the Grand Canyon on the river, I'm probably not going to provide that. You're just going to have to disconnect for a few days, and that might be good for you. But if you're up there on the rim or you're in Yosemite Valley, I believe that they should have reasonable connectivity to be able to share that experience. The other thing is that Park Service is, I like to say, we're content rich. We're not very good at supplying that content via today's apps and other digital media. We need the private sector to do that for us and step up and begin to, you know, build on this content that we have and help sort of deepen the public's experience through digital access.
And can you promise there won't be a cell tower dressed up like a tree so that people say, look at that cell tower dressed up like a tree?
You know, there's one down in the southwest that, you know, sticking up out of the desert, and I always thought that was, that is the largest saguaro cactus, and, you know, and it looks like something from outer space. No, we're not going to be putting any of those up in the national parks.
Actually, that's a serious topic, I guess. If you need to get that connectivity, there has to be some technical means of getting it there. Are you looking at alternatives to the classical tower?
Well, I think technology is moving really quickly in this space, and I've seen opportunities. We stood up wireless on the north rim of the Grand Canyon a couple of years ago with dishes the size of a dinner plate, you know, hidden under the eaves of the buildings, and we had really strong broadband the whole time we were there. It was a temporary setup that we had brought one of the tech companies to stand up. So I think there's opportunities to do this without impacting the parks or the viewshed.
And getting to the issue of buildings that you mentioned, the big maintenance backlog, close to $12 billion, how is that looking, and does it look like Congress is supporting you a little bit more in trying to address some of those issues?
Let me characterize the backlog. It is very close to $12 billion. About half of that backlog are what I call our transportation assets. Those are the roads and bridges, culverts, parking lots, and even transportation systems like buses and things like that in the park system. And so there is, so about roughly half of that backlog is that. And Congress did pass a five-year transportation bill, of which the Park Service gets an increasing amount of money annually out of that, as well as can compete for some of these sort of mega projects like the Arlington Memorial Bridge here in Washington, D.C. So, yes, Congress has stepped up, I think, in the transportation side of our assets. On the non-transportation assets, that's kind of our visitor centers, utility systems, historic homes, you know, the basic infrastructure. Congress has not been quite as generous on that one, and we're still working with them. We're looking at some new models of how we can finance some of this. Obviously, philanthropy is part of it. Our fee program is part of it. And, you know, we would like to have some broader authorities to even consider sort of a bonding approach to some of this. So we're working with Congress through centennial legislation, which is actually on the Hill as we speak, to give us some new authorities to really address this this significant backlog. And we do need to get ahead of it, and we do need to get Congress to help us out with it.
How often do you get out of Washington to be able to visit some of the 400 facilities at the Park Service overseas?
I'm on the road a lot. I'm probably, you know, 2 to 3 weeks out of every month, I'm somewhere in the field. Not just to visit, though I love visiting them, usually I'm sort of drawn to the flame, you know, I'm drawn to where the issues are.
And for a superintendent of a place like the Grand Canyon or Yosemite, what is their life like? How do they live? How much time do they spend outdoors? And what kinds of buildings do they occupy?
I tell you, I was a superintendent in three parks, Wrangell St. Elias in Alaska, Craters of the Moon in Idaho, and Mount Rainier National Park in Washington. And I must say, these are the best jobs in government. It varies depending on the park, but often you live inside the boundaries of the park in a home that was constructed for the superintendent. It's usually often they're historic. and modest, but really nice, and usually in a nice setting. So you basically wake up in the morning and you're at work. There is a park community associated with the employees, and you get to know their families and interact with them both professionally and off duty as well. You know, some big parks like the Grand Canyon, they have a full school inside the park. There are literally several thousand people living inside the park, both employees and employees of our concessioners. And you're kind of the superintendent's kind of like the mayor to a certain degree, involved in all aspects of the operations. And it's never a dull moment, and it's a lot of fun.
And as someone who's been there 40 years and now sentenced to Washington, do you have your own particular favorites among the parks?
I love all my children, as I like to say. Can't pick any favorites.
But maybe Mount Rainier, maybe. I'm just guessing.
Well, I had a lot of fun at Mount Rainier. It was it's a great, fantastic park with complicated issues. What I loved about Mount Rainier is the park is just adored by the public in and around the Northwest. I mean, people just love to come to Rainier. They have a good time at Rainier. They bring their families. It's multi-generational, deep connections to that park.